My name is Jeff Cook. I'm a writer at Siemens PLM Software. We provide software systems and services used throughout the automotive supply chain, which means our people are knee-deep in trends you read about daily. Electric vehicles, driver assist and self-driving technologies, mobility services, smart cities, and more. This podcast is an ongoing series of conversations with these people and others we're working with in the industry. Thanks for listening. Think of the future of transportation, the distant future. What do you see? Or maybe, what don't you see? Car dealerships? Those might be scarce if private ownership of vehicles goes away. Bumper-to-bumper highway traffic? That might be a memory too when roads are full of high-speed pod caravans. What about boredom on those long family road trips? No chance, since pod interiors are going to be configurable and of course connected to the internet. Hey Dad, for the next trip to Grandma's, can we get the living room lounger with the hologram option? A couple of decades ago, this kind of future may have seemed far-fetched, something out of the movies or a good sci-fi book, maybe. However, given what's going on with autonomous vehicles and mobility services, this version of the future is closer than we think. Okay, maybe not the self-driving living room lounger pod for the trip to Grandma's, but a whole slew of technologies and systems are upending the way we get around.
3 years ago, because of our work in specialized areas, I became the thought leader for autonomous cars and future car technologies. And at first, that had to do a lot with just writing articles and things like that. And eventually, we've parlayed that into working on actual hardware projects. Initially, work with the city of Boston here, and also in racing applications.
This is Ed Bernardin, Vice President of Strategic Automotive Initiatives at Siemens PLM. I got intrigued to meet Ed after reading a paper he wrote called The Future Car, which is a great yarn about where things might be headed in personal transportation. Basically, it's a pretty optimistic blueprint for a more personal, safe, and very human-scale future. Turns out Ed in conversation is a personable guy and not just a smart technologist who's looking way down the road. He races go-karts with his son, plays guitar, grows grapes in his backyard for wine, and he's working on self-driving car technology today.
This whole autonomous car discussion, you know, if you go back just like 2 or 3 years, people were hardly even talking about it at the time. And but it became popular so quickly, and the expectations of what these cars were going to do were way up there. And you know, there's talk, oh, by 2020 we're going to have autonomous cars out on the streets, and people are going to start buying cars in the early 2020s and that type of thing. And like you mentioned, the Gartner hype cycle for emerging technologies predicts this very thing, that there's going to be this inflation of expectations, and it's going to reach a peak, which probably was within the last year or so, and then things are going to go downhill. And they call it trough of disillusionment. And certainly the accidents that we've seen over the last few months are throwing the autonomous cars into this trough of disillusionment. It was, I think, towards the end of last year, there were some, I guess what you could call minor accidents now, but there was an accident in Las Vegas where they released a shuttle bus, and within a couple of hours, it had an accident with a big 18-wheeler. And it wasn't even the fault of the autonomous car, but there's a lot of talk just starting then, and certainly what we've seen more recently with Uber and you know, the death of a pedestrian has caused many cities and autonomous car companies to take a step back. Boston, I think, for instance, and the state of Massachusetts backed off. The city of Pittsburgh, you know, backed off on testing. It's actually come back now. That's and you know, they're starting to realize that that's really what comes with technology when you're starting to introduce it. But it's probably made things more realistic. And I think that this is not just something that's unique to autonomous cars. But if you look at things even that's part of our everyday lives now, like electricity, for instance, we can't live without it. But when it was first introduced, there were actually many accidents and even deaths. And I think that although they're unfortunate and it'll spur companies to do everything they can to make sure it doesn't happen again. It's probably something that we're going to avoid, try to avoid, but certainly is going to happen as we try and introduce such a drastically new technology as this.
Self-driving vehicles will have to go through a lot of testing before they can reach consumers. And these tests are not as simple as crash test dummy scenarios you might remember from car commercials. There are many levels when it comes to testing. The reason is there's a whole nested set of components that need to work well and work well together for a car to drive itself. There are chips, software and machine learning algorithms, sensors, data and electrical networks, and more. All those systems must be tested on their own and then strung together and tested exhaustively again, both in all sorts of software-based simulations and eventually in prototype vehicles on test tracks and public roads.
Just continuing on this theme of safety, it seems like, I mean, a lot of the stories about safety, or maybe for just kind of the general public or mere mortals out there, it's like, am I going to be safe as a, obviously as a pedestrian or a cyclist, or am I going to be safe as a passenger in a car that's mostly driving itself, level four, level five vehicle? We're still, as you just said, many years out from that sort of full automation. And it seems like there's this, there's an idea out there in the industry, or an argument about whether we can sort of safely navigate the level three, the human, the handoff to a human driver. I just heard an interview with a woman named Missy Cummins, who's a professor at Duke. I don't know if you ever come across her, and she's among those who says that, you know, level three shouldn't even, we should just skip that outright. It's just so problematic, the handoff to a human driver. It's fundamentally dangerous, and there's lots of evidence to this fact. How do you see, are we going to have this kind of spectrum of going from level two to level four or five, or how do you see us, what's the right way to approach this handoff to a, with this gradual decoupling of, you know, human input to the computer taking over? What's the right way to approach that or think about that?
Well, certainly there has to be a gradual introduction in some way. But I believe that skipping level three probably does make sense for many of the reasons you were alluding to. It takes some time for a human that's been, you know, eating a sandwich or watching a movie to come back to the level where they can actually control a car. And that number is say, 8 to 12 seconds, somewhere in there. So if an autonomous car can handle something and they alert the human, and it takes 8 to 12 seconds for them to come back to realization of what's going on, and then another few seconds for them to press the brake pedal, and you're going 60 miles an hour, you're going to travel pretty far in that 12 seconds. You're probably, it's equivalent to about three football fields. So you go back, you may go 200-300 yards, and a lot can happen in that amount of time and in that distance. So trying to solve that problem is going to be really tough. And, you know, humans have a tendency to want to use up time in any way they can if they're idle. In fact, when automatic transmissions were introduced and people started trying to find something to do with the hand that used to be doing the shifting, you know, put a sandwich in it or a phone or whatever it is, even though automatic transmissions are probably a safer technology than manual transmissions, the number of accidents went up. So skipping level three makes sense. So now you're going to go to level four or five, and you're saying, all right, well, fundamentally, we've eliminated a big problem, which is figuring out how to alert humans in a short amount of time so that they don't have an accident when they have to take over. But you introduce new problems, which is the ability for an autonomous car to operate in, let's say, in all conditions. I mean, ideally, that's what you want. So autonomous cars are going to have trouble, right? In severe weather, blinding snowstorms, it's going to be harder where there's a lot of pedestrian traffic, maybe out in the countryside where you might have cows or deers or something like that crossing the road. So the gradual introduction of autonomous cars, rather than thinking of it in terms of by level, is to say, let's go to full autonomy or get as close to it as we can, but let's control the environment in which the autonomous car operates.
And this is how testing works, right? Trial and error. But the realm of acceptable errors is limited given the life and death nature of driving. We can't release a fleet of prototype self-driving cars on the road. It's not practical. It's not the safest thing to do. There's stories that come out routinely about the number of road test miles logged by prototype vehicles. I think it's the California DMV issues a disengagement report that has the miles in it. And I saw one a couple months ago, Google or Waymo is way out in the lead, though there's others that are catching him, or Cruise Automation in particular is logged more than 100,000 miles, I think, in California. That's what gets most of the attention. But meanwhile, there's something from the RAND Corporation that says we're going to need many billions of miles of testing. Toyota's CEO said also a number, I think, that's in the billions. So there's a huge gap between road tests and what people say is required. So how is simulation going to play a role here in sort of meeting the test burden with autonomous vehicles?
Well, the statement by the CEO of Toyota, right, I think it was 14 billion miles of testing is required. And so let's say that's for a level 5 autonomous vehicle. If you look at a level 0 or level 1 automation, like ABS, you know, for braking, you require only hundreds of tests, right? A couple of hundred tests, get it out there on the road or the test track. So when you go from level 1 and 2, where we are now, where you need maybe hundreds or maybe 1,000 tests, to requiring billions, it's just not practical to be able to do that on the open road. So simulation is going to play a key role in this. So in order for it to play a key role, it also, you have to be able to trust it. And simulation is going to be required at different levels, right? At the very basic level, simulating of the fundamental technology is required. So you have to simulate the sensors, like the LIDARs and the cameras and the radar, whatever you're using there, the control algorithms that are in the vehicle itself and its dynamics, how the tires connect with the road in different conditions, that kind of thing. So there you got your whole vehicle and all its systems. So that's one level of simulation. Then you have to simulate traffic flow, right? And how traffic flow may change so that you can create all the different scenarios that you have. And then you have to, even at a higher level, you have to simulate all the objects that are in the environment, the trees, traffic lights, where they're positioned, all those types of things. Now, there are simulations at all these different levels, but they aren't all connected together yet. And as a result, these connections have to be made. It's not a gigantic technical hurdle, but something that has to occur. And for instance, as an example, if you're simulating an autonomous car with radar.
Radar sensors use radio waves to determine speed and location of objects. Radar is generally cheap and robust and is a basic sensor on most, if not all, autonomous vehicle prototypes. In fact, radar has been used for years in semi-autonomous driver assist systems like adaptive cruise control.
You've captured this model of the environment, and there's trees and guard posts and things like that. The images that radar gets back from an object, if it's made from metal or from wood, is actually different, and it would react potentially in a different way. So just having a model of a city and not knowing what that model is and the materials it's made from and its radar reflectivity or whatever it might be, that type of information, all of that rich data has to be exchanged between these applications. So that's something that can happen and probably will happen over time as all these applications are brought together. And let's say we get to that point, which is probably not too far into the future. The next thing is okay, is this simulation accurate? And that's going to require running the simulation and then comparing it to what really happened. And over time and many, many tests of the simulation itself, you're finally going to build confidence in it. And that brings us to the last point, which is, okay, if you have a new technology in a car, level one and two, where we are now, and a new car design, you actually crash one of the vehicles, and there's all sorts of tests, standardized tests for crashing them, and you know that that vehicle's safe. Well, now you can't test all aspects of this vehicle to make sure it's safe. You're going to have to actually use simulation in the regulatory process. And so the government's going to want to make sure that these simulations are accurate, right? Because it's not all physical testing. So simulation, yes, will have to play a part. Simulation will have to evolve so that you can bring in as many aspects of simulation from the city level to the traffic flow level down to the sensors in the car, right? That's going to have to happen. And then finally, if simulation, and that if is probably going to happen, is going to be used in actual regulation, then companies and the government is going to have to build trust that those simulations are accurate enough that they can regulate the vehicles that they allow onto the road. So yes, simulation is going to be important, and a lot of work's going to have to be done to get it to the level where it can actually be used to do everything that it needs to do to make sure that when vehicles are allowed onto the street, that they are going to be safe.
Once tests are complete and self-driving technology is deemed safe for the consumer population, how we think about transportation is bound to change. History has shown us this. One day, owning or even driving a car to travel may become a thing of the past.
I know you're from the Midwest. I lived in Lansing for several years in Ann Arbor. I find it hard to believe in the Midwest with those big open spaces that we're going to get to that future anytime soon. But how do you see it, this shift to mobility services? How quickly is it going to happen?
I think it's more of a matter of when. And you're seeing this transition to mobility as a service already. It's many times it's cheaper to take a Lyft or an Uber, certainly if you live in the suburbs, to the airport, than hiring a taxi. Certainly more convenient. I mean, for people that live in cities and they do their work and their play within that city, where parking is almost impossible to find or very difficult, it's perfect for moving around. And certainly if you plan to go out and maybe have a few drinks or something like that, it's safer to use these types of services. And the cost has come way down compared to what a taxi used to cost.
It makes you wonder, what place will cars have in the future? How will we look back on the way most of us, with keys in our pocket and cars in the driveway, get around today?
Getting back to the idea of the Midwest and being being a lover of driving and of cars, I mean, if you're a sports car owner today and you want to drive that sports car to work, chances are if you're in a big city, you're going 5 to 10 miles an hour, you're going zero, now you're going 15, maybe get up to 35 for a few minutes and finally you get to work. It's what a sports car doesn't do anything for you there. And so the idea that these in the future, if you're going to drive, you might as well have real fun driving. And that's where off-road driving is going to become where you really get the experience of being behind the wheel, like horses today, right? Where horses used to be transportation in cities and between cities. Now they're for entertainment and enjoyment in special, stables and tracks or whatever.
I was talking to my daughter is 11, my older daughter. And last year, I heard a quip from a technology executive somewhere that imagine that your daughter needs to go to soccer practice and you're making dinner and you can send her in the autonomous vehicle and you can stay home and finish dinner. And I ran that by my daughter and she said, "Dad, why don't you drive me to soccer and the car can make dinner?" And I had to laugh, the perspective of a 11-year-old. Though, as you just talked through that, I should have told her that you could ride in the autonomous car and it'll, play your favorite Netflix videos or YouTube videos while you're chatting with your friends. And then she would say, "Absolutely, put me in the car and you stay home."
You mean she wouldn't want to chat with you while she's in the autonomous car?
That's, with a preteen, your credibility goes down exponentially, I've noticed.
But no, your point's a real good one, right? Of, you know, maybe she's had a bad day at school and she does want to talk to you and her mother or whatever it might be. That's that idea that what's the experience I want to have while I spend this next 15 minutes or 2 hours moving from A to B? And it could be anything from a soothing talk with her father to make everything be all right to, you know, playing a video game or texting with friends. It's just going to be a different way of thinking about travel.
Toward the end of our conversation, I thought I'd run through a few rapid-fire questions with Ed. Self-driving cars use different kinds of sensors to get to know their environment. I thought I might try a different mode of questioning to get to know Ed a bit more.
So, first question, what is your favorite go-to source for information about autonomous vehicles? Is it a blog or a book or an individual reporter or analyst you follow? Where do you go to get your information?
I have a couple of newsletters, maybe three or four, that I read every day and certainly scan. And those provide links that, you know, keep the trail of knowledge building as you follow through on those. Some of them are real technical, like IEEE, for instance. Other ones are more related to autonomous technologies or software. Others, you know, even articles, newsletters like The Verge, which is really about technology in general, I'll scan that real quick. And if there's something in there that's about autonomous cars, it probably means there's something pretty significant happening. And then I'll follow up on that.
Maybe we can include a link to some of those in the show notes. Second question. So you've had quite an interesting career, and it's a great perch you have here at Siemens and what you're working on and your perspective. What advice do you have for someone who might want to get into the automotive industry and work on autonomous driving in particular?
One thing is if you're completely outside of that world, building up some expertise in taking courses at a university or some online sources like Udacity, for instance, has a course on a certification course on autonomous car engineering. Those are always helpful. If you're just coming out of school or you're more recently out and been working for a few years and maybe in an unrelated field, sometimes just trying to get some experience, even if you have to work for free for a while, might be a good way to build up the experience in certain areas so that someone's, you know, willing to work with you. But the good thing, I think, is that there's a shortage of engineers. So doing anything you can to build expertise in the software, the electronics area, it's probably not that hard to get a job. You know, if you have a proven track record of being a hard worker and being able to learn quickly.
Third question, what do you say is the biggest technical problem standing in the way of full automation, a full level 4, level 5 vehicles?
The whole thing about testing these vehicles in different conditions and making sure that they really work, is the logic that's behind them and all their programs going to handle all the different situations? That's probably a big challenge. But as we spoke about before, if you're going to gradually introduce this technology, getting everyone to agree on what that should be is probably not so easy either, right? Well, are we going to do the single lane on the highway, or are we going to have special sections of cities? And of course, not a technical problem, but who's going to pay for all this? Especially if it's cities and their infrastructure, that's a big question as well. And then there's always from the non-technical side is when are people really going to trust these things and be willing to allow it to pick up their kid at school? That's probably the question you got to ask. Would you let this pick up your kid at school or not? And I think that's even a harder question to answer than when would you be willing to be in the vehicle, right? So that level of trust is, you know, a social issue that is going to take a long, long time and many, many years.
A big thanks to our guest, Ed Bernardin, Vice President of Strategic Automotive Initiatives at Siemens PLM. Ed has lots more to say on this topic. He's a New England guy, which makes it all the more remarkable to me that he can grow grapes to make wine. That's another story. His white paper actually sketches out a future where you might take a historical tour through Boston in an autonomous pod with a holographic Paul Revere who would narrate as you go. Pretty cool. Next time, we'll be talking more about the challenge of simulation and testing autonomous vehicles, and how we're eventually going to go from science project prototype to mass market production of these vehicles. Our guest will be Dave Lausen, another Siemens PLM vice president. Dave cut his teeth at Lee Iacocca's Chrysler in the 1980s, helped launch an electric vehicle startup in the aughts, and is quite a story in his own right. Thanks for joining us today, and for more, visit Siemens PLM Software online. Siemens PLM Software is a world-leading provider of product lifecycle management and manufacturing operations management software. We help thousands of companies realize innovation by optimizing their processes from planning and development through manufacturing, production, and support.